Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This episode of True Murder is brought to you by Audible, the world's leading name in digital audiobooks. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/truemurder, this month a 30-day free trial and an audiobook of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/truemurder. In 2003, he began to appear in gay pornographic movies, occasionally working as a dancer and escort. In 2005, he appeared as a pinup model in an issue of Toronto's Fab magazine. In 2007, he was an unsuccessful competitor in a reality series Cover Guy and underwent numerous cosmetic surgeries, auditioning for a reality show, Plastic Makes Perfect 2, in 2008, and set up at least 70 Facebook pages and 20 websites under various aliases. On May 25, 2012, an 11-minute video titled One Lunatic, One Ice Pick was uploaded to a gore site, depicting a naked male tied to a bed frame being repeatedly stabbed with an ice pick and a knife, then dismembered, followed by acts of necrophilia and cannibalism. The perpetrator uses a knife and fork to cut off some of the flesh and gets a dog to chew on the body. On May 29th, a janitor discovered the decomposing torso of Chinese foreign student Lin Jun inside a suitcase in the alley behind an apartment building in Montreal. A package containing a foot was delivered to the national headquarters of the Conservative Party. Another containing a hand was addressed to the Liberal Party. Packages containing severed limbs were later sent to elementary schools. Magnotta fled Canada, becoming the subject of an Interpol red notice and prompting an international manhunt. He was apprehended June 4th at an internet cafe in Berlin, reading news about himself. Materials promoting the video appeared online 10 days before the murder. The high-profile trial in Montreal lasted 10 weeks. Luca Rocco Magnotta pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. First-degree murder or insanity? The story that we're profiling this evening is Psycho Killer Superstar, the Luca Magnotta debacle, with yours truly, Dan Zupansky. Now, Eric Clinton Kirk Newman was born on July 24, 1982, in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada, to teen parents Donald Newman and Anna Yorkin. He had two younger siblings, a brother Conrad Shane and a sister Melissa. The early years of the Newman's marriage appears to have been relatively happy, and after initially living with Donald Newman's parents, the couple purchased a house for the family in Bethany, Toronto. Donald Newman worked in the warehouse of Lever Brothers factory in downtown Toronto, while his wife, Anna Yorkin, homeschooled the three Newman siblings for 5 or 6 years. The Newman family lost their home due to credit card debt, and the family had to move back in with Donald Newman's parents. The Newman children, however, finally got to go to school. From grade 6, Eric attended Charlottetown Junior High School in Toronto. In 1994, when Eric was 12, his parents divorced. He and his brother and his sister remained with their mother and her new partner, Leo, with whom Anna then had a further two children. Around this time, Eric went to live with his grandmother, Phyllis Yerkin, in Lindsay, Ontario, in the same southern Ontario area. Eric Newman attended L.E. Weldon Secondary School during grades 10 and 11. In April 2001, aged 18, Luca Magnotta, Eric Newton, was seen several times by community workers in a crisis center at Ross Memorial Hospital in Lindsay, Ontario. He had gone in complaining of a sore throat, but said he heard voices. He was referred to a psychiatrist who said, "I'm not sure what we're dealing with. Bizarre, interesting presentation." The psychiatrist wondered if there were secondary gains that Eric Newman was looking for. Health workers noted that they suspected he might be faking. August 26th of 2001, he arrives at emergency at Ross Memorial Hospital because he is out of medication. The medical file notes a personality disorder, and he is prescribed medication. The next day, Luca Magnotta returns to emergency at Ross Memorial Hospital, having taken the entire bottle of his prescribed medication. A diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia is noted in his medical file. Eric Newman makes an application for the Ontario Disability Support Program, ODSP, citing textbook symptoms of schizophrenia and receives an award of $1,000 per month in welfare payments. In 2001, Luca Magnotta lives at Harrison House, Lindsay, Ontario, a supported housing project, group home, for people with mental health issues. Apparently, it's reported he feels isolated in this group home. In 2002 and entering into 2003, Eric was now going by the pseudonym of Jimmy. And he branched out from working as a male model, as he claimed, to embarking as a male escort, offering his services to a male clientele, describing himself as being either bisexual or heterosexual and strictly gay for pay. In 2003, Luca's biological father, Donald Newman, refers Luca to his own psychiatrist because he notices that Luca has problems, and Donald Newman's medical records dated March 7, 2003 show that Donald Newman, who was diagnosed with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, was concerned for Eric's mental health because he believed that Eric was hearing voices at that time. According to his father, Eric spent a period of time as a patient in a psychiatric ward. Now, on February 28th to March, Eric is a patient of psychiatrist Dr. Sirabalam. He sees this doctor regularly between February 28th and in 2003, right till 2008. He tells his doctor on the very first appointment that he thought police were after him, and he admits to hospital at that time, because he claims he wants to kill himself. On April 6, 2003, Eric again is living in Harrison House in Lindsay, Ontario, where he's admitted to a Rouge Valley Health Centenary Center. He's discharged the following day with a follow-up an appointment. And while he's living at this Harrison House, he claims that he thought people were jealous of him and wanted him out of the home. And he tells the doctor, "I am going to be a celebrity, a superstar." Still in 2003, he had several consultations with his family doctor, Dr. Alan Tan, and he was concerned about his weight loss and erectile difficulties. The doctor undertook some tests, including STD screening, and he prescribed medication to help with the erectile problems. And he gave him, apparently, nutritional advice, dietary advice. Now, in 2003, he begins calling himself Luca, and he's 20 years old, and he's featured in his first gay pornographic video. On October 30th of that year, he sees Dr. Tan, again about his ongoing weight loss and erectile problems. He sees an intake nurse later who noted from his medical file that he had bipolar disorder and a mild form of schizophrenia, they wrote, and that he had been being treated with Valium and antipsychotics, and that he had had 3 hospitalizations because of mania. Now, on January 6, 2004, he moves from Lindsay, Ontario to Toronto and starts living with a Greek family. He continues with his modeling and escort career, and he appears in a second gay pornographic film in 2004. In August of 2004, he attends North York General Hospital, Toronto, complaining of stress and hearing voices. They conduct a CT scan, which was negative. Still in August 19th, he tells his psychiatrist, Dr. Surabhan, that he has started going to the Church of Scientology and has now moved in with a Jamaican family. In September of 2004, Luca Magnotta, which is what he's going by now, is hospitalized for a week and a half, suffering with depression. 2004, he's also charged in connection with a $17,000 fraud of a person with a mental disability. He'd run up numerous charges on this credit card, totaling the $17,000 and the subsequent fraud. He also, in January of the next year, he appears in an issue of a gay scene magazine calling himself Jimmy and describes himself as a 22-year-old soccer fan born in Russia who hopes to train to become a police officer. In 2005, he also makes a further 3 gay pornographic films. And in March of that year, Luca sees his doctor, Dr. Tan, and he tells him that they are trying to ruin his career by taking pictures of him and posting them online. He complains of hearing voices and paranoia, and he believes people are following him. Dr. Tan records in his medical notes that Luca's speech is odd, fast, and delusional, but not that he was not suicidal. In April to May of 2005, is Luca's back living with his father and stepmother in Scarborough, Ontario. He again sees Dr. Tan, complaining that people are watching him with binoculars. Dr. Tan's assessment, finally, is that Luca is suffering from schizophrenia. May 30th of 2005, after receiving a letter from Luca's mother, Anna Yurkin, concerned at her son's mental health regarding the upcoming fraud trial, Dr. Surbalin writes to Luca Magnotta's defense lawyer, Peter Scully, stating that Luca Magnotta is suffering from paranoid schizophrenia. He tells him that Magnotta had been hospitalized twice in 2003 after he missed medication because he didn't come to his outpatient appointments. In June of that year, 2005, Luca is convicted on the 3 counts of fraud against Sears, The Brick, and Audio Video. And he spends 16 days in custody during the pretrial, and he receives a 9-month conditional sentence, which means no jail time, with 12 months of probation on the condition he adheres to a treatment program for undisclosed, unnamed mental health issues. On July 20th, 2005, Luca asks his doctor, Dr. Tan, for a referral to a new psychiatrist because he wishes to switch from his father's psychiatrist. In January 2006, Luca is introduced to transgendered Barbie Swallows, that's her stage name, and she describes a whirlwind romance between the two, and she claims she moves in with him into his new apartment. Luca makes another gay video in 2006. And on July 17, 2006, Eric Clinton Kirk Newman legally changed his name to Luca Rocco Magnotta. On the 13th of September, Luca Magnotta sees his family doctor, Dr. Tan, has stitches removed from a hair transplant, complains of erectile dysfunction, and is prescribed Viagra. And he says he tells Dr. Tan that he changed his name because he was being followed. Still in January of 2007, he tells his Dr. Surabalin that he has started modeling. And he tells Dr. Surabalin that police were investigating him. People didn't like him, he said, and they were receiving calls from the USA. In 2007, Luca Magnotta appears in another issue of a gay magazine. He makes a breakthrough into the world of reality television shows, first giving an interview with Naked News, calling himself Jimmy. He gives a lengthy interview about his life as a high-class escort and stripper. And then, after apparently having plastic surgery to look more like his idol James Dean, he auditions for Cover Guy, hoping to win the prize of further plastic surgery, but he's not put through to the next round. He nonetheless enjoys the opportunity to talk on camera about himself. Now, he tells his doctor in August that people are spreading rumors about him that he was dating serial killer Carla Homolka. And he's also having trouble sleeping. In September, he appears on a radio phone-in show on Toronto's AM 640, and he gives an interview to the Toronto Sun denying rumors that he was dating notorious serial killer Carla Homolka. It is widely speculated at that time that Luca Magnotta was the entire source of many of those internet rumors. In 2008, Luca Magnotta's activities start to take on what some have called an increasingly dark and twisted edge. Throughout 2008, he sets up multiple accounts on YouTube to wage war against the Family Guy TV show as he tries to get it banned, and earning him considerable derision and a legion of haters on YouTube. He also posts several disturbing blogs about incestuous relationships. In January, a Wikipedia shell page is created from 2007 by Luca Magnotta about himself, and it is deleted after lengthy discussion by Wiki contributors and administrators, concluding that Luca Magnotta was a non-notable model porn actor. In February 2008, Magnotta auditions for another reality show, Plastic Makes Perfect 2, hoping to win more plastic surgery, and he was unsuccessful. 2009, he is featured in another gay pornographic movie, and on the 16th of May, Luca Magnotta Facebook page is created. The first of 70 Facebook accounts it is claimed that he created at that time. From June 2009 to July 2009, he sets up a journal page and posts 44 articles about himself and his life in the space of just over a week. After this, he seems to appear from the internet for almost a year. In October 2009, Magnotta starts seeing Dr. Robert Weinstein at North York General Hospital, and he tells Dr. Weinstein that he had a boyfriend when he was 19 who had nosebleeds, and he painted the words, "I love you," with blood on his apartment door. And after 19, everything was different. Dr. Weinstein diagnosed Luca Magnotta as schizophrenic, somewhat unstable, and he was taking a real estate agent course, and the Dr. Weinstein noted that must be stressful. Now, on December 21st, 2010, Army veteran Ryan Boyle was surfing the web in his office in Maryland, watching YouTube and the Funny Pictures thread on 4chan. Now, 4chan is a simple image-based bulletin board where anyone can post comments and share images. And this is where he encountered a still image of a video called One Boy, Two Kittens. Boyle scrolled through the comments, posts from horrified users hoping to ID the man who'd posted the kitten-killing video to the forum. In the video was a figure in a dark green hoodie, asphyxiating two kittens with a vacuum cleaner in a plastic bag. In the background of the video clip, people were speaking in a foreign language, sounding possibly Russian. Boyle was a big animal guy. This hit him personally. He wanted to see the guy pay. He immediately started a Facebook group, Save to Kitty. Boyle then clicked back to 4chan to get people over to his Facebook page and noticed that another user had started up a page as well. He contacted the other page's administration to ask to join forces. Boyle became an administrator of the Facebook page, Find the Vacuumer Kitten Killer for Great Justice. Now Boyle, who had set up the group as an invite only, was getting 100 requests for access per hour, accepting each new member. On the same day that Boyle started Find the Vacuumer Kitten Killer, a woman on the west coast of the U.S., using the internet alias Body Movin', saw the video in her Facebook feed and found her way to the group. She had been following an animal mutilation case on 4chan and became intrigued at how users were able to identify a Texas goth girl responsible for posting photos featuring the decapitation of a dog. She found it fascinating how they used the data from the phone and the EXIF, exchangeable image file format, which contains information such as file format, often along with time, date, and GPS data, and matched up the images from the dog head. With her background in IT, Movin' felt she could help find the person who'd murdered the kittens. Now, she wasn't the only one. In Sydney, Australia, a 47-year-old woman using the alias Nicey Punk had become intrigued with the search. Another man, John Green, saw One Boy, Two Kittens on 4chan. He was familiar with pet torture videos. Green joined the group on December 23rd. Christy, a 34-year-old from Texas, joined and solved one mystery. She was the one who made the original plea on 4chan. At the time, Christy ran the gore site Oh Look a Forum, which was the top search result for a snuff video called Three Guys, One Hammer. A user named BabyMaggie2 had embedded a YouTube video for One Boy, Two Kittens. She took the video down immediately as they had a no animal cruelty rule. Since she wanted him to get caught, though, she posted the info to the bulletin boards on 4chan. The crew of Avengers began tossing around theories. They started by looking at objects in the killer's room that were visible on the video. The bedspread was decorated with an image of a wolf. Where was it sold? The voices in the background, were they actually Russian? The electrical outlets, were they European or North American? They pursued any visual clue that might help them identify the figure in the green hoodie. But after thousands of man hours, the group was no closer to finding out the identity of the figure in the dark green hooded sweatshirt. At the same time in Hollywood, Sia Barbie, one half of the Barbie twins, sister models who gained fame in 1991 after posing in Playboy, was receiving emails directing her to the One Boy, Two Kittens video. A longtime animal advocate, Barbie, along with her twin sister Shane, had recently lobbied online for the Animal Crush Video Prohibition Act, which sought to ban sexual fetish videos featuring people, mostly women, crushing small vertebrae animals with high heels or bare feet. The bill had passed on November 2010, which raised the twins' profile in the media as enemies of animal abuse videos. Sia Barbie joined the Vacuumer Kitten Killer Facebook group, informing the group that she had media connections that could help spread the word. To that end, Barbie reached out to Joe Panzarella, who had been deluged with emails directing him to the video. Panzarella is one of the leaders of Rescue Inc., a collection of bikers who fight against animal abuse on Long Island, New York. The group had received national attention from their 2009 reality show on the National Geographic Channel, which followed the biker boys as they confronted animal abusers throughout New York. It lasted only one season, but while the show was fleeting, it boosted the club's online profile, and Panzarelli says they were contacted from people from every part of the world concerning one boy, two kittens. Now, in an attempt to get some clarity amidst the disorder, Boyle started a second smaller Facebook group calling it Useful Individuals and invited the users from the main Vacuumer Kitten Killer group, who he thought had the best skills, hackers, investigators, filmmakers, artists, to help identify the figure in the green hoodie. Nicey punked user Russian language skills to theorize that the accents of the laughing voices heard in the background of the video just didn't match up with items in the apartment. The group worked through the new year, and by January 8, 2011, many believed they had found the kitten killer. A member had found the profile of a Facebook user calling himself Jamsey Crams a Lot in His Ass. Jamsey had posted a video to his Facebook page of a cat in a cage being set on fire. And the photos on his profile were of a teenage boy with similar facial features to the blurry green figure in the green hoodie. Was this the killer? Panzarelli, who readily admits he's not a nice guy, wasn't content to wait and see. Along with the Barbie twins, he came up with a plan to bring Jamsey out into the open. My sister said we would have to lure this person in, said Panzarella. We would have to give him something irresistible. Panzarella enlisted a member of Rescue Inc. who was a grade school teacher and a female bodybuilder. The woman began a Facebook dialogue with Jamsey, attempting to appeal to his narcissistic ego and to reveal himself. After some back and forth, Jamsey admitted to the female bodybuilder that he was, in fact, the hooded figure in the One Boy, Two Kittens video. Case solved. Rescue Inc. thought they had their man. But the members of the Vancouver Vacuumer Kitten Killer group, they wanted proof. We didn't think Jamsey was him, says Boyle. We thought he was just a troll. The Vacuumer Kitten Killer administrators were skeptical that this was their man. But the focus on Jamsey Crams a Lot in His Ass had a welcome side effect. Less than a day after the group publicly identified Jamsey as the culprit behind One Boy, Two Kittens, Nicey Punk received a Facebook message from a user named Beverly Kent. The name of the kitten vacuumer you are looking for, read the message, is Luca Magnotta. Nicey forwarded the message to the administrators of the group. We Googled Luca Magnotta, she says, and there we were. The search came back with the equivalent of twisted internet gold. Articles on chintzy user-generated sites detailing Magnotta's jet-set lifestyle, and hundreds of photos, Luca on a beach, Luca in a sports car, Luca in a limo, in a hot tub, under the Eiffel Tower. His hairstyles would vary, but his chiseled jaw, high cheekbones, and bright blue eyes remain the same, a twink James Dean, often shirtless, always pouting, and almost always alone. There was a Magnotta video sideshow showing a thin young man in multiple outfits and poses, and it was set to New Order's True Faith. The articles and images were mainly from user-generated sites, message boards, and photo buckets, but there were a few from legitimate news outlets. Homolka rumor ruins model's life, read the headline, to a video link from a September 2007 Toronto Sun interview with Magnotta, in which he denied that he dated infamous Canadian murderess Carla Homolka. Now, while the citizen detectives were happy to finally put a name and a face to their supposed culprit, they were bewildered by what they were finding. On first glance, Luca Magnotta didn't seem real. Hundreds of posts about Magnotta appeared on various forums. This is a fan page I made for Luca Magnotta, my new idol. Or on a YouTube page. Luca Magnotta arrested in New Mexico for trying to gain access to Area 51, says local authorities. Or on a Flickr page. I saw something tonight on YouTube where someone had stated that River and Luca were cousins. Is that so? On a River Phoenix fan website. Magnotta himself was the source of these comments and questions. It was established that he had created at least 70 sock puppet accounts on Facebook and at least 20 websites devoted to Luca Magnotta. His Google carpet bombing helped his name show up when people searched for famous or infamous names. He was trying to troll people to get famous, says Movin about Magnotta. Bottom line. Then there's this unwritten rule of the internet, says Vacuumer Kitten Killer Group member Green. It's called Rule Zero, and it's you don't mess with cats. Not unless, that is, you want the attention. So Magnotta made one boy, two kittens, and posted on December 21st, 2010. What better way to get famous, Movin, than to fuck with cats? But while Magnotta made efforts to conceal his identity, he was also hungry for more notoriety. He posted photos of himself in connection with the video, holding the cats on the bed, but no one recognized him. This was before the catfish secret weapon Google search by image, and TinEye, the image search tool of the time, was crude at best. After 3 weeks of lurking in the Facebook group devoted to his own capture, watching users toss out new theories, dissecting every clue in his video, Magnotta seemed to want more. On January 11, 2011, the Barbie twins worked with extreme animal rights group Negotiation Is Over to publish an article on their site declaring Luca Magnotta as the kitten killer, though claiming he was also known by the name, the alias, Jamsy Cramsalot in His Ass. After an intense investigation, another anonymous tip resulted in the positive identification of the well-known bisexual porn star and model Luca Magnotta, read the article. Commonly known for drugs, wild parties, and gay clubs, his name is well-known in Canada and in northern United States regarding stories about him being involved with Carla Homolka, a hated serial killer. Luca, 25, lives in Montpellier, France, and travels frequently between his home in France and Tolyatti, Russia. Well, much of the above information was wrong. Magnotta's name was now in the open. Magnotta felt enough pressure to meet with an attorney. On January 12th, he wrote to a Manhattan lawyer named Romeo Salta, not so much denying his involvement in the video, more claiming truthfully, as it were, that he was not Jamsy. The citizen detectives had a name and they had a face. What they were missing was a location. No one knew where Magnotta actually was. And because of that, and the fact that he was just a guy killing kittens, says Green and Movin, no law enforcement agency was going to give time or effort to finding him. Rescue Inc.'s Panzarella came up with an idea, however. If they couldn't find Luca, maybe they could get Luca to come to them. He wants to be a porn star, says Panzarella. I called the Barbie twins. They said, we can get Ron Jeremy. The Barbie twins and Panzarella hatched a plan to try and lure Magnotta out of hiding by offering him a role in a porn movie with adult film legend Ron Jeremy. The plot called for Magnotta to show up in a Los Angeles studio to perform in a film. Once on set, Rescue Inc. members would grab him, make a citizen's arrest, and hand him over to the authorities. At first, Ron Jeremy was on board, so long as he didn't have to do anything gay. We were playing along with him wanting to be a porn star, says Jeremy. But Panzarella was upfront with Jeremy about the risks. Magnotta could show up early, and Jeremy could be alone with the kitten killer. The more Jeremy thought about it, the more the deception became too real for him. The plan fell apart. Either way, Green and Movin broke away and started a new closed Facebook page and stopped posting in the public group. "We knew Luca was in there," says Movin. They focused on analyzing the numerous images they found on Magnata online. From London to Russia to Miami to Hollywood, it looked like he got around. But one particular photo sparked their interest, and they were able to narrow down where it was taken precisely. Among the hundreds of pictures that Magnata sprinkled across the internet, many of which turned out to be photoshopped, there was one of him standing on a balcony of a high-rise. Behind him, you could see a Petro-Canada gas station. Now, there are more than 1,500 Petro-Canada stations across Canada, but armed with EXIF data that Movin pulled, she and Green focused on Toronto. From there, they dug deeper and came upon one of the pseudo-news articles in which Magnata talked about the paparazzi trying to photograph him outside his condo in the Toronto suburb of Etobicoke. Now, Etobicoke is small, so Green did a search and found only 9 Petro-Canada gas stations in the area. "I started to look at Google Maps and the street view," says Green, "and the fourth one, boom, there was the building with the balcony." So they had a name and an exact address and proof he was in Toronto at the time. Now, this was enough concrete information to be taken seriously by the authorities. In January 2011, Movin and Green contacted the Ontario branch of the Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, SPCA, and delivered a large document containing evidence from the video, comparisons of known photos of Magnata with stills from the video, and reasons they believed he was in Toronto. SPCA investigators and communications officer Brad Dewar was receptive and began working with the Toronto police. "They were quick to jump on board and help us with this case," says Dewar of the authorities. A file was started on Magnata, and the police visited the building and likely talked with the landlord. The information was correct. The photo was taken there. Magnata had lived there, but he had moved out 2 years prior. He left no forwarding address. The trial went cold. The trail went cold. Now, the posts on the Vacuumer Kitten Killer Facebook group began to wane, and people moved on to other events. A 4-month-old puppy mutilated in Texas, a man accused of killing 55 dogs in Montana, a dog attacked with a machete in Florida. Occasionally, a member would ask about the kitten killer. Eventually, Boyle handed reins of the Vacuumer Kitten Killer Facebook group to Movin, Green, and Nicey Punk, and they used it as an outpost for their newly formed Animal Beta project. Still hopeful, they set Google and news alerts for Luca Magnata and waited. On December 2nd, 2011, a video titled "Python Christmas" appeared on the site Flix, posted from an account registered in England. The video showed a live kitten being fed to a python. Another video was posted showing a kitten duct taped to the end of a stick and being drowned in a bathtub. Green, Movin, and the rest of the detectives began to research these new videos. They found that Facebook pages discussing the videos had been set up just a month earlier, and pictures of the cats were posted in November as well. "A month before the videos appeared," said Green, "he was talking about it. That's Luca's MO. He tries to create a buzz." Now, to try to determine where Magnata was now, they spotted a photo in front of Buckingham Palace. Magnata had photoshopped himself into photos of landmarks before. But it turns out this time he actually was in Britain in December. On December 8th, Sun UK reporter Alex West tweeted to Luca, "If you want to talk, follow me and I'll DM you." Magnata went to the Sun newsroom to deny allegations that he killed the kittens. The reporter, Alex West, then found him at the pub he was staying above and conducted a 20-minute interview. Then on December 12th, an email from someone calling himself John Kilbride, the name of one of the infamous Moore's victims, was sent to the Sun. It ended with, "So, I have to disappear for a while until people quit bothering me. But next time you hear from me, it will be in a movie I am producing that will have some humans in it, not just pussies. I will, however, send you a copy of the new video I'm going to be making. Once you kill and taste blood, it's impossible to stop." West said he contacted Scotland Yard, but Magnotta was gone again. Green tweeted to the RSPCA, providing them a link to the lengthy dossier on Magnotta that he had created, and also reached out to West with no luck. Green and Movin began feverishly analyzing the new activity, but Luca had again disappeared inside the internet. But in January 2012, they spotted something odd. A comment made from what they believed to be one of Magnotta's sock puppet Facebook accounts. On a Facebook page of an obscure Montreal house DJ named Three Star. It was something about, without a connection to Montreal, a person would never have posted. In the middle of the video was a photo of Magnotta standing on a set of unique stone steps. It was not something that could be found in just any city. We started working on that picture. We took notes of the trees, the foliage, the streetlights. We went street by street, city by city. They discovered that the same streetlights and crosswalks from the photo were located in Montreal. The group quickly contacted a Toronto detective who explained that the case was now out of his jurisdiction and they would need to file a complaint with the Montreal SPCA. After months and months of searching, they thought they might get some help. All they said was, "It's just cats. There's nothing we can do about it. We don't have time for this." They just kept pressing them, but they told them to go to the police. "Montreal's a big city. We didn't know exactly where he was. We didn't find a lot because a lot of it was on the internet. We didn't know when it happened and where it happened. When they went to a prosecutor to get an arrest warrant, they didn't succeed. At that time, Magnotta was not a murderer." On March 3rd, a post was made in blogspot.ca titled "Necrophiliac Serial Killer Luca Magnotta." A month later, on April 22nd and 24th, four videos were posted by user Rita Van Volkenberg on YouTube, all with the same title, "Cannibal Serial Killer Luca Magnotta," but in multiple languages. On May 15th, an anonymous Yahoo post talked about a video circulating on TOR, the Onion Router, or the Deep Web. "All I know is that it was shot in San Francisco. I've been trying to find it for weeks." The same day, YouTube user Alex Volerich uploaded a video containing a still photo of a figure in a purple hooded sweatshirt holding an ice pick in a stabbing position. It was titled "One Lunatic, One Ice Pick Video." A thread on www.psychforms.com was started declaring that the "One Lunatic, One Ice Pick" video was real and was created by a 20-year-old in San Francisco. On May 25, 2012, a video titled "One Lunatic, One Ice Pick" was uploaded to the gore sites The YNC and Best Gore, destinations for explicit videos and images of real-life blood and guts that draw millions of monthly viewers. This seemingly edited video This is going to be an opportunity for me to take a break right now when we just started to talk about the video that was uploaded on May 25th. It's central to this incredible trial and this incredible story. I wanted to mention that for all the fans of True Murder that this episode has been brought to you by Audible. Audible is the world's leading name in digital audiobooks. And right now, you can get a 30-day free trial and the free audiobook of your choice, your desire. And you can pick from about 150,000 titles. And right now, experience the audiobook, the Audible audiobook experience. Now, out of those 150,000 titles, especially interesting to, I think, this audience, is three Audible audiobooks in particular. In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Again, the book was said to have revolutionized the nonfiction book writing world with an incredible crime in a small town in America, Midwest America. One of the leading authors of the time, best-selling authors, decided to write about this case and became inextricably involved in one of the most incredible true crime stories the world has ever known. Hence, it is one of the true crime classics, In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Now, the Audible experience is narrated by a brilliant narrator, Scott Brick. And so he takes you inside this book like you've never experienced it before with the Audible audiobook. Another great offering is, of course, another true crime classic, the biggest true crime selling book of all time, written by prosecutor Vincent Bulugosi and Kent Gentry, 1969, the almost unbelievable murders of the Charles Manson and his followers. And Vincent Bulugosi, right from the very beginning, led the investigation, was involved in the prosecution, and wrote the definitive book about Charles Manson, his followers, the incredible phenomena that was 1969 and the end of the hippie era. It has been talked about for years, it's been discussed, and as much as you think you might know, you've read all about it, this is the book, the classic book, Helter Skelter, by Vincent Bulugosi, again, narrated by the brilliant Scott Brick, and Helter Skelter, an incredible, incredible true crime book. Another incredible offering is the book by Damien Eccles, Life After Death. Now, he's part of the West Memphis Three, and he spent 18 years on death row, falsely accused of murdering three young boys. He and his friends were eventually exonerated in 2011, and in his book, he chronicles his journey right from the beginning accusation to his eventual release from prison. Now, the book is just a few years old. It has fabulous reviews on the Audible site, and quite uniquely is narrated by Damien Eccles himself. And so that's Life After Death by Damien Eccles, another incredible true crime offering from Audible, one of the 150,000 titles, or more than 150,000 titles that are available now. You need to go to audiblepodcast.com/truemurder, go for a 30-day free trial, and choose one incredible audiobook of your choosing and experience Audible today. That's audiblepodcast.com/truemurder. Now, the video that was uploaded on May 25th starts off with a 80s band called New Order and a song called Faith. Very much like a rock video might be, there is some editing in the first 53 seconds or so with the soundtrack in the background. We see a seemingly young man loosely bound with some rope, but obviously alive and seemingly not in any kind of distress, with a towel or some fabric over his face. After that 53 seconds, it is, with any kind of analysis, you should see the perpetrator enter into the frame and with a knife, clad in a dark hoodie and with a glove, he begins to stab this body over and over and over again, quickly. And in the midsection of this naked torso that's on the bed now, with a black towel over the victim's head and his arm over his chest and his left arm to his side. The body, of course, motionless. And there is no blood, surprisingly, coming out of those wounds. As I say, the face is covered with a black towel or some fabric. For a good minute, the perpetrator continues to stab and stab and stab with this knife, looking like about maybe a 6-inch or so blade, not a huge knife. On the screen, it says the YNC.com, noting the gore site that first posted this, I believe. Again, like I say, there seems to be editing, and then the next scene, he does a close-up with the camera. Now he's out of the frame himself, but it looks like he's grabbed the camera and is zeroing in on a close-up of the wounds. And again, we see numerous wounds. There's red involved, but there's no blood oozing out. Shortly after, he then starts making long slices in the legs, in the right leg of the victim. And again, surprisingly, there's no blood coming out immediately. But you can see very clearly these slices are deep and long and resulting in deep gashes to the flesh. The music continues, and as does the editing. There's a poster of Casablanca movie on the wall. Now he shows the victim with his head decapitated close to the body, but definitely showing the head bloodied and decapitated, now not without the towel or the fabric obscuring it. He now rotates this head, grabbing it by the hair, and near a scale, I guess, like a measuring guide to show the head, but keeps twisting the head around. He then takes the knife, which is, again, there's more editing. He proceeds to slice the arm off near the shoulder, just keeps sawing at this arm, continuing to cut into the flesh. Again, this is obviously edited, and we are seeing close-ups of the actual amputation. He slices into the back of the victim, again, long slices that very soon show up on the screen. Again, a YNC.com showing the gore site that this has been posted to. He's doing crisscross slicing on the back of the victim. The body now is on its stomach. The arm has been severed completely off. He grabs it by the wrist and is fondling his own genitalia with the hand of the severed limb. There is no bed sheet on the bed itself. There's a great amount of blood on that mattress. He continues to defile this body with this limb. Now he shows one of the limbs with the bone jutting out, the other leg almost completely severed off, the man decapitated, now on his stomach. He continues to slice now the entire leg off, the right leg. The next edit shows the body now on its stomach, legless, headless, and the hooded figure mounts the body from behind and sodomizes the legless corpse. Again, with the music. Now it's edited and shows both legs cut off just below the buttocks. He is then now shown with a knife, a steak knife, and a fork, crisscross cutting into the flesh, with some difficulty trying to get quite a significant chunk of flesh from this victim's buttocks. And then he takes that piece of flesh that he has some difficulty finally cutting from the buttocks and appears to put the piece of flesh on the fork to his own mouth. A small dog, he continues cutting with the knife and fork. A small dog enters the scene and begins licking, biting, and nibbling on the flesh of the leg, the stump of the leg of the victim. Somewhat later, he shows stills of his handiwork, the severed arm in the freezer of a fridge, and the leg, the decapitated corpse in various scenes. As I say, it's edited. And finally, he takes the severed arm again, lays on the bed, removes his clothes, but all you can see is his widespread legs and him again defiling the body part on his own genitalia, masturbating with it, and then shows at the end shots, close-ups of his finished handiwork and close-ups of the severed limbs themselves, the head, and shows the measurement, the head before and after being severed. And that is the end of the video. Now, Luca Magnotta Now, Magnotta flew from Montreal to Paris on May 26th, using a false passport under the name Kirk Trammell. His cell phone signal was traced to a hotel in Bagnolet, but he had left by the time police arrived. Pornographic magazines and an air sickness bag were found in the hotel room. He had contacts in Paris from a previous visit in 2010, and police were following a large framed man who had been in contact with Magnotta. Another man he stayed with for two nights did not realize who he was until he had left. Magnotta then boarded a Eurolines bus at the Bagnolet coach station bound for Berlin, Germany, and arrived May 31st. Frank Rupert's first contact with Magnotta was April or May 2012 when they hooked up via an online chat site called Gay Romeo. Now, he initially expected Magnotta in Paris on June 4th. Instead, he arrived May 27th. He spent a few days there first and arrived in Berlin on May 31st. He arrived in Berlin with a few thousand euros, no luggage, and reportedly looking for a fresh start after breaking up with his lover in the French capital. Over the 4 days, the two men used Google Translate on their respective laptops to communicate as neither spoke the other's language. They spent much of their time together shopping, eating, and drinking. They didn't have sex because Magnotta was not his type and appeared much older than in his online profile age of 22 or 23. During their time together, Rupert only knew the accused as Kirk or by his gay Romeo username, William2323. He took some photos of Magnotta because he said he wanted to set up a new gay Romeo account, so he began working on as an escort in Berlin. They went to gay bars so Magnotta could talk to other foreigners about their escort experiences. They socialized for 4 days without anything untoward really happening. Magnotta seemed generous and often bought drinks and meals for others. On June 4, 2012, the pair had parted ways for a few hours because Rupert was not comfortable with the accused staying alone at his apartment while he ran an errand. Rupert told Magnotta he should go to an internet cafe to pass the time. It was during that time apart that Rupert picked up a newspaper and saw a mugshot of Magnotta, alongside a story describing an international manhunt for his arrest on suspicion of murder. Now, Rupert contacted police and waited at a nearby station. A man named Kader Anlaisley was working at his job at an internet cafe in Berlin. At 11 a.m., a man walked in wearing sunglasses and makeup and said, "Bonjour, Internet." Now, Anlaisley would describe himself as a news junkie, recognized the face, but couldn't quite place it. Now, from his workstation, he was looking at the monitors of his customers and noticed that the man in sunglasses was viewing numerous articles about a killer in Montreal that Anlaisley had read about. And then it clicked. This was him. Now, Anlaisley flagged down a group of cadets in training that happened to be passing by, and they immediately confronted Magnotta, who initially gave him a false name, and quickly told them, "You got me." And they found on his monitor, Magnotta had been Googling photos and articles about himself. Magnotta was nabbed, and police seized personal items from Rupert's apartment. Right at that time, the German police wished him a happy birthday. And he told the police that it wasn't his birthday, and police insisted, "Oh yes, it is your birthday. You could have been next." Now, the murder tape was made from raw video files that were later recovered from Magnotta's camera. The full unedited tape included the actual sounds recorded during the murder. The long version of the video revealed that Lynn's throat had been slashed prior to the brutal stabbings, I guess hence no blood, and that the likely cause of death was the cut to the throat. And in the long version of the video, it is confirmed, not just hinted at, that there was cannibalism, acts of cannibalism. Now, Luca Magnotta is arrested in Berlin. He waives his extradition. He's brought back to Canada. And this trial begins. And this trial ended in December. It is now February 2015. It ended in December. And at the trial, of course, it took 10 weeks. I called all kinds of witnesses, and there was, as I painstakingly brought you through all the evidence that was used for their psychiatric defense, that he was insane at the time of the murder, that he was insane before that, that he was schizophrenic. And ultimately, they had testimony from psychiatrists to say that he was insane, that he was schizophrenic, that he had been diagnosed as having psychiatric issues before, and as a result, he would not be responsible for his murder. He did not, could not discern right from wrong. Now, at trial, Luca Rocco Magnotta said voices instructed him to kill Jun Lin amid his own fears. A Chinese student was a Canadian government agent who had been sent to kill him. And a psychiatrist testified at trial. Magnotta said, "Something forced me to do it." Now, 20 months after the slaying, Magnotta began providing the psychiatrist Allard with details of the events, telling her Lin replied to his advertisement on Craigslist seeking a bondage partner. He said he met Lin for the first time that night near a subway station before walking several blocks back to Magnotta's apartment. Magnotta told Allard that they drank wine and had sex. And Magnotta was the first to be tied up, but complained Lin was going too fast and was hurting him, striking him about the head. Now, Allard said that Magnotta then became very anxious and took some sleep medication, and that Lin also asked for some as well. At one point, Magnotta said he saw a black car parked outside his building and became paranoid about a government conspiracy involving Lin. Allard said Magnotta began hearing voices telling him to tie up Lin and to cut it and to do it. He's from the government. Subsequently, Magnotta slit his throat and decapitated him. Jun Lin was the unfortunate victim of a psychotic man, Allard said. Mr. Magnotta killed who he thought was a government agent. A psychiatrist testified that Magnotta said he published the One Lunatic, One Ice Pick video of Lin in an effort to shut out the voices. Before his slaying, Lin had reportedly consented to having their sexual acts filmed. 6 days earlier, Magnotta had a similar encounter with an unidentified man, but with Lin, something just happened in my brain, he said. Once Lin's body was dismembered, Magnotta said he kept hearing voices telling him to give it back to government. And various parts of Lin's body were sent in packages to political party offices in Ottawa and two elementary schools in British Columbia. Magnotta said he considered sending Lin's torso but could not figure out how. Asked why body parts were mailed to two Vancouver schools, Magnotta told Allard he discussed the Western Canadian city with Lin. He hardly slept after Lin's slaying, he said, but he did remember eating pizza at one point. And he said, "It's very scary how I could do that," referring to the killing. Now, the obsession with government and spying was present when his schizophrenia was initially diagnosed, Allard said. And Magnotta told Allard that antipsychotic medications helped ease the paranoia, but he didn't take them all the time. He said the fear of being spied on led to frequent address changes, multiple online profiles, the use of a wig, and various changes of cell phone numbers. Allard said he changed his name to Magnotta in part of that same fear, but also because he wanted to get away from his family. He chose the surname either for a video game character or a popular winery in Ontario's Niagara region. While Magnotta didn't think he was currently being spied on, he was convinced it happened in the past. In an earlier testimony, Allard said Magnotta told him about an email he sent a British tabloid for telling the murder of a human being. He said that this was only meant as a threat to a journalist who had ambushed him after talking about the kitten killing video. Now, the Crown contended that the communication to the London Sun suggested Magnotta was clearly planning the slaying up to 6 months in advance of Lynn's killing. But Allard said he told that Magnotta said he was only trying to intimidate the reporter Alex West, and he said that Magnotta had always thought his plan to kill someone was stupid and showed a real lack of judgment. Allard told the jury Magnotta thought his tactic of sending the email had worked because no story was published following his encounter with West. Allard said that he believed Magnotta was suffering from schizophrenia and was in a psychosis when he killed Lynn. He talked also about that Magnotta admitted making up his affair with convicted killer Collar Homolka in 2007. He said Magnotta was seeking notoriety, but primarily wanted people to believe he was the victim of harassment. He said the Homolka story spread quickly and Magnotta lost control. He said that Magnotta said he was not proud of this. He felt ashamed. Allard admitted that Magnotta said he hid his schizophrenia symptoms from Montreal doctors a few weeks before Lynn's killing because he was reportedly afraid that revealing them would prevent him from moving to France to start a new life. It was a plan he hatched a few weeks earlier, convinced the government was spying on him. And he said Magnotta went to great lengths to hide his schizophrenia because of the reaction others had towards his father, who also had the mental disease. "I don't want to be like that," he told her. They were afraid of him. At court, they asked, why was Magnotta wearing Lynn's hat hours after the Chinese student slaying and dismemberment if he believed Lynn was an agent? Was it kept as a trophy? If it was meant as a message to the government, why was the so-called murder video of Lynn's gruesome death published on a Gore website and not sent directly to the government? Why did Magnotta leave his apartment at 2 a.m. if he thought government officials spying him were in a dark vehicle outside? The trial lasted 10 weeks. The jury deliberated for 3 days and then asked the judge a question. Is a personality disorder considered a mental disorder? And the judge answered back, yes. The only question left to decide was whether the mental illness rendered him unable to know right from wrong. After 8.5 days, the jury came back with a first-degree murder conviction. On February 17th of 2015, Luca Rocco Magnotta formally withdrew his appeal of a conviction in the first-degree murder of Jun Lin, deciding ultimately he didn't want to go through a possible second trial. Magnotta appeared before the Quebec Court of Appeal by video conference from jail on Wednesday, where a judge asked him if he was abandoning his appeal voluntarily. Magnotta replied that he was and didn't need more time to consider his decision. Now, the dropping of the appeal could facilitate a meeting between Lynn's father, Duren Lin, and Magnotta. Magnotta's Montreal lawyer and a Montreal lawyer who represent Jun Lin's family said they'd be open to a meeting with Magnotta when the appeal issue was out of the way. Lin's father, Duren Lin, wants Magnotta to clear up many unanswered questions he has about his son's death. He wants to hear something, some kind of response, some remorse from the killer of his son, and he would like to learn more about what happened that night. Magnotta's Toronto-based lawyer, Luc Leclerc, said Magnotta, too, would be open to a meeting with Duren Lin. I want to thank you very much for listening to this very dry recitation of an incredible crime. There has been no book so far about the Luka Magnotta trial. Some of the best information and some really good writing, despite my poor attempt at narrating it, came from Rolling Stone article about animal activists being involved in the hunt for Luka Magnotta. So if you look that up in a past issue of Rolling Stone, I believe it's Animal Instinct, I believe that the article is called, and that's where I gave this incredible amount of information with all the American ties and all these activists getting online and trying to hunt down this kitten killer. And as they warned the authorities at that time, and I did mention, they said, this guy, these people end up being serial killers. They end up moving from animals to killers. And so while they're on the trail, a little too late, Luka Magnotta struck. And that's why we call this episode Psycho Killer Superstar. Remember, this episode of True Murder was brought to you by Audible, the leading name in digital audiobooks. Please go to audiblepodcast.com/truemurder for your 30-day free trial and a free audiobook of your choice right now. Good night.